Very good. So, we are continuing our look at Matthew chapter 8. Matthew chapter 8. We started talking about the there we go. There's the word cloud for Matthew chapter 8. We started talking about the blind man. There we go. The blind man that was healed. We talked about him, that first one there in Mark chapter 8, verses 22 through 26. And we had started talking about the Peter's great confession, the great confession there in Mark chapter 8, verses 27 through 30. We didn't get all the way through. We talked a little bit about the location, and that location is Caesarea Philippi. They were in Bethsaida, which we see in verse 22, when they healed the blind man, and they're heading up to Caesarea Philippi. We talked a little bit about that place, and that's where they were going to, that's where Jesus wanted to question his disciples concerning this great question he was going to ask them. And that first question is, who do men say that I am? And we talked about different possibilities about about what men had said. This is sort of a repeat of what was stated there in Mark chapter 6, verses 14 and 15. A lot of the people at that point thought certain things about who Jesus was as well. But we note that some people thought he was John the Baptist, that some people thought he was Elijah. And some of that's understandable because John the Baptist, or rather Elijah, was indeed prophesied to return, and so that is a reasonable hypothesis if one didn't have all the information, such as who John the Baptist was. So that is who people thought that he was. Now, we didn't quite get to the big question. The big question here on who do you say that I am? We see the confession here, the confession. And he finally asks Jesus, after all that has happened, after all that we see here in Mark so far, all the way up from chapters one all the way up to this point in chapter 8. The answer to this question should be obvious to anyone who's following along, to anyone who's paying attention. Of course, it wasn't, at least to them. At least it didn't seem that way. And so Jesus asks this all-important question, and he makes it more personal. He says, first he starts off by saying, who do men say that I am? What do people think about me? What's the word out there? Now he applies it to them. He says, okay, he says to the outer world, who am I? What do they think I am? Who do they think that I am? Now, what about you? Who do you say that I am? And so that's what he says in verse 29. He said to them, but who do you say that I am? Peter answered and said to him, you are the Christ. Now, this is perhaps one of the more succinct ways of putting it. We see it in Mark chapter 16. That's perhaps the one that we cite the most often. But we also see it in Luke. I don't exactly remember where that is, but we also see it there. So that's a question that is so important for his disciples to understand who he is. This is the climax to this particular section of the book of Mark. What all that's happened has been building up to this point, the healing of the lepers, the healing, the raising of the dead, the healing of the demoniacs, the feeding of the 5,000 and the 4,000, all this stuff. It's all been leading up to this point. It's all been leading up to this point. This group of people, these disciples, were fairly average. I mean, they were fishermen. They weren't especially learned. They weren't. In fact, some of them were zealots, and some of them were tax collectors, and some of them were thieves. Still was, as Judas Iscariot, anyway. But we see that. that this is an average group of people. And Jesus wants this average group of people to recognize Jesus. That they're average now, don't get me wrong. They're average now. They become extraordinary because of Jesus. But at this point, they're not quite there yet. They're still your average Jewish guy of that time. So it is unclear whether or not they all believed about what Jesus said or about what Peter said, you are the Christ. It's unclear whether they all believed this before this confession or not. And Sam mentioned this last time, I think, or maybe a time before that. But John mentions Nathanael in John chapter 1 and verse 4, 49 rather. John chapter 1 and verse 49, and that states Nathanael answered and said to him, Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel. And he confesses right there who he is. Matthew and John record that sometime after the feeding of the 5,000 and the walking on the water, they made a similar confession. We see in Matthew chapter 14, verse 33. Matthew chapter 14, verse 33, it says, then those who were in the boat came and worshiped him, saying, truly, you are the Son of God. So they were beginning to recognize him here. They had made a confession there as well. After this, also in John chapter 6 and verse 69, it says, Peter says, also we have come to believe and know that you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. Now, I think those are parallel accounts, referring to, at least at this point, I haven't looked that closely at it, but unless somebody else has any other opinion on that, that might have a better idea. I think that those are parallel accounts, Matthew chapter 14, 33 and John 6, 69. We note that they made a confession before this confession here in Mark chapter 8. And that Mark chapter 8 confession is parallel with the Mark chapter 16 or Matthew chapter 16 confession. So they have confessions throughout the book, the books of the gospel accounts. But there are also expressions of disbelief or doubt that we see throughout the gospel accounts as well up to this point. Calming the storm. In Mark chapter 4 and verse 41, it says, and they feared exceedingly and said to one another, who can this be that even the wind and the sea obey him? Again, this is an expression of fear that they had here. In fact, they had a hardened heart after Jesus walked on the water. In Mark chapter 6, verse 52, for they had not understood. Excuse me, for they had not understood about the loaves because their heart was hardened. And they just weren't getting it even up to the point in Mark chapter 8. In Mark chapter 8, verse 17. but Jesus, being aware of it, said to them, why do you reason? Because you have, and then he goes on. They didn't understand who Jesus was. We talked about that a few weeks ago. So they just weren't getting it, and yet they had made previous confessions, yet their heart was hardened. So it's evident, I think, that their belief waxed and waned over the years. I think this is close to the end of the ministry, probably several months, perhaps, before the crucifixion, or at most several months. Despite their confession after Jesus had walked on the water in Matthew chapter 14, verse 33, their hearts were still hardened, according to Mark 6, 52. That's the same context, the same event that's being talked about, that Matthew is talking about, that they made a confession, and Mark is talking about that their hearts were hardened. So now I have a question. How is it possible that their faith seemed to vacillate like that, to go back and forth. Why did it go from having that hardened heart along with a confession of faith? How could they have made that earlier confession with a hardened heart? And I have another question. Do people still do that today? Could their hearts, especially the disciples, could their hearts still be hardened here in Mark chapter 8? So just some thoughts. Any thoughts on that? Any ideas there?
Before you asked the question, I was thinking, you know, this sounds so much like the Jews back in the Old Testament, and you know, it's brought so strongly forth in the book of Judges, that every generation, this is, you know, there rose a generation who did not remember, right? And it's such a human thing for us. You know, what would it have been like if every disciple that Jesus met as soon as he called them turned into super faith people, you know, that never had any problems, never had any doubts, got everything immediately? You know, it would be hard to relate to these people. And I think one of the things that I appreciate about Jesus selecting the apostles, and he did, right? So he got exactly who he wanted, was that there in each of them, you can find something that says, yep, that's more like me. And I know as Christians, our faith waxes and wanes, right? We can have a strong faith, a weak faith, and our faith can struggle. Even as Christians, even though we know the whole story, even though we can read about the resurrection. One thing for sure, the disciples and the apostles after the resurrection didn't have any problem with their faith anymore.
Yeah, that's right. And now they weren't perfect, and no one's claiming that they are, so they did have some hiccups there. But for the most part, yeah, they there was no indication that their faith had left them. And so, but before that, you know, they're just like any of us. You know, we have those moments where we doubt, where we're just not sure. John the Baptist, I mean, he saw Jesus being baptized. He was the one who proclaimed that this was the Lamb of God, the one who was going to take the sins away from the whole world. And yet, even while he was in jail, when he was in prison, he sent disciples to ask Jesus, "Hey, are you the one? Should we look for another?" He seemed to have some doubts even then. And so we're not, you know, it's not, I don't think it's a sin necessarily to question. I don't think because it's important for us to be able to make these questions and to ask these questions so that we might be able to have answers and so that we can continue to dig deep and to have ourselves solidified, ultimately solidified in our faith. And I think that's an important characteristic of our lives as Christians. Let's see. I think that there. So the last question I had on here: could their hearts still be hardened? They're making this confession here. Could their hearts still be hardened? Well, I think later we'll see that it was. I think later we'll see that it was. So we looked at all those verses. So I'll let you copy those down if you want. That's if you're listening, Mark 4:41 and 6:52 and 8:17 in reference to the facts that. It shows that the disciples were doubting, that they had feared, that their hearts were hardened, that they just didn't get it. And they still don't get it. In fact, but before we get to that, Jesus needed, he needed them to get this. He needed them to get all this before he began the next leg of his ministry. And we see that this is why, one of the reasons why this is a turning point. Why we go from one section of this gospel account to the next. We see that this is the point at which He is looking toward the cross. He is starting his march toward the cross after this confession. He had to make sure that those closest to him understood who he was, at least to some extent, before he could move on. Even though they wouldn't fully understand until his resurrection and at Pentecost, they still needed to see men like trees walking. So if you remember, this is the state that they're in. The miracle we read about last week was the miracle of Jesus healing this blind man. And this blind man is sort of almost an allegory to what the disciples are going through right now, because Jesus heals him partially, and then he, for the first time, and then the second time heals him fully. So it almost seems like an allegory of what the disciples are going through. Yeah, I'm not able to see things clearly yet. I see things kind of murkily. Yeah, I see that you are the Christ, but I don't really know what that means yet. I don't know what that means. And in fact, in the next section, when we talk about the last several verses of Mark 8, we'll note that they didn't understand what that meant. They're only seeing men like trees walking, like the first time that the first time that Jesus had tried to heal this blind man, only healed him partially. All right, so then in verse 30, then he strictly warned them that they should tell no one about him. So we see this continuation of this, what's called a messianic secret, the secret that Jesus doesn't want other people to know who he is. He orders his disciples to tell, at this point also, to tell no one of their confession. Now, you know, again, we've talked about this before, but this might be the first time it's actually followed. Though to be fair, we don't know about the blind man in verse 26, a little bit earlier on. So the question now is, at this point in Jesus's ministry, what's even the point in trying to keep it a secret? I mean, we have him, almost on his way to Jerusalem in order to be crucified. We'll see that he doesn't enter Jerusalem until chapter 11, but he is on his way there now. So at this point, why try to hide it? Why try to hide it? Any thoughts on why that is? All right, probably nothing more than what we had been talking about already. Perhaps, and I have a couple thoughts on why, perhaps fewer people would believe Jesus, if his disciples began making grandiose claims. Perhaps if people, oh, he thinks he's that? Oh, I don't know about that. Perhaps the answers are the same as before that we've talked about. That they were, there was still more for him to do before his enemies tried to kill him in earnest. We saw that they were making plans all the way back in chapter 3. But now it's time, now, but if he begins to reveal himself more, then they might try to accelerate their plans. Or perhaps, and I think this is probably one of the more likely, perhaps he wanted to avoid being made an earthly king. Now, we've seen in other gospel accounts that's what they tried to do. They thought, oh, this guy, he's done so many great things. We got to take him and make him our king. And I think John especially talks about that. I think he probably just wants to avoid that kind of situation again, because that's not who he is. That's not who he's going to be, at least not their expectation of who the Messiah is going to be. We note that the disciples misunderstood the purpose of the coming of the Messiah even as quickly as the next few verses. In fact, we'll look at that in a little bit. I think we've got time. And even as late as Acts chapter 1, will you again restore the kingdom to Israel? Even as late as that point, they still didn't get it. They still didn't get who this Messiah was and the purpose of his coming. Whatever the case, it was not his time to be revealed yet. But soon. But soon. All right. So, all right. So I'm having a little trouble following along because my phone has died and I'm using the iPad, but it's not loading it for some reason. So I'm looking at it on the computer, which is, I got my outline up and the PowerPoint, so it's difficult to keep up with it. But I see now that Pam commented it was time for his death, or at least it would be. It would be soon, yes. And Sam said, Jesus is fully in control of his ministry. He did exactly what he planned to do. And that's exactly right, too. He's working toward getting his disciples up to speed, trying to help them to understand who he is. And they're finally seeing the truth partially. They're not seeing the full truth yet. And so hopefully that will come soon. Now, we're going to move on into the next section, into this and secret. So if you remember this, all the way back when we started Mark, the basic outline of the Gospel of Mark, we see the preparation. We see the kind of like an introduction in the first 15 verses. And then we see Jesus' ministry in Galilee in chapter 1, verse 16, all the way to 8:30. And so that's his time in Galilee. And now in this section from 8:31 to 10:52, we're looking at his time in his transition going from Galilee to Jerusalem. And so that's the next section that we're looking at. His Galilean ministry is just about up. There are still some last remaining things he's going to do in Galilee before he heads to Jerusalem and that march toward Golgotha, that march toward Calvary. So, let's see. So again, chapter 8. So we now have a change in the... we now have a change in the top from Galilee to Jerusalem. And then we see that this is preparation. He's preparing his disciples. He's preparing himself for the end, for his march to the cross. And then now we're going to look at his final events in Galilee in 8:31, all the way to chapter 9, verse 50, which is through the end of chapter 9. All right. So we're going to look at this next section, call for commitment. There is a call for commitment. Let's go ahead and read this section here, 8:31 through 9:1. And he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed, and after 3 days rise again. He spoke this word openly. Then Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But when he had turned around and looked at his disciples, he rebuked Peter, saying, "Get behind me, Satan, for you are not mindful of the things of God, but the things of men." When he had called the people to himself with his disciples also, he said to them, "Whoever desires to come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever desires to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? Or what will a man give in exchange for his soul? For whoever is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of him the Son of Man also will be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels." Then he said to them, "Assuredly I say to you, that there are some standing here who will not taste death till they see the kingdom of God present with power." All right. So that is Mark chapter 8, verses 31 through chapter 9, verse 1. All right, so we're looking at this transition period. There is a particular transition, again, because we're moving from one section to another. And so, all right, so we're looking, let's see, let me pull up. Right, so all right, he is still in Galilee. Now, Caesarea Philippi is not in Galilee, but it is in the northern parts of Palestine. He's still in that particular section there. And he's there for a little while longer. But we note his eyes are now set to Jerusalem and what is going to be happening there. We read of the first of his, so at the beginning here, we read of the first of his crucifixion and resurrection predictions here in verse 31. He says, he doesn't, it's not a direct quote, but he says that he's talking about the fact that he must suffer many things, that he's going to be rejected, killed, and he'll rise again. So he talks about these things here. Now, there was one previously to this in chapter 2, verse 20, but it was vague and not likely and likely not understood very well. But now his focus is on the cross and preparing himself and his disciples for it. We see a transition moving us toward the suffering part. So remember the idea of this lesson, the whole concept here is that the whole concept is that he is the suffering servant. That's the whole idea behind this book, right? So he's moving. He's still well. He's before this point, he was a servant working so hard to help everybody. Often beleaguered and tired and not given a moment's rest or a moment to himself. He's helping and healing other people, but now he foretells that he will suffer even more. And we see that he does, and then after this point, we see that he doesn't do nearly as many miracles. There are only three more specific miracles recorded in the book of Mark. And two are in this section, the healing of an epileptic. And let's see, do I have that up here? No, the healing of an epileptic. One other that I can't think of. Oh, healing of blind Bartimaeus. Healing of the epileptic, healing of a blind Bartimaeus, and the cursing of a fig tree. But that last one is in Mark chapter 11, and in Mark chapter 11, we note that it is only the disciples were present for that one. So, looking back, the overview Bible. So I've got this thing here, the overview Bible. Which I found to be very very helpful in trying to break this down. Now he has a different way of going about it than I would probably go about it, but there's some interesting points that are brought up here. He divides this section 8:31 to 10:52. He divides this section into three parts, and we'll note those three parts here, and that they're divided, and then he connects them to the Yeah, to the three parts of the first section. So we note that for this first one is right here, and he divides them up by how many times Jesus predicts his death. And so he predicts his death three times in this section. And this first one we see here in 8:31. The next one we'll see later, and as we will the next one. And then he connects it with the previous section. So we note in this particular one that he is connecting the idea of the kingdom is near from the first section in well from the first few verses to this point. And we note that the similarity between this between 1:15 that he's talking about the coming of the kingdom of God and also in 9:1, when he talks about there are some standing here who will not taste death till they see the kingdom of God present with power. So we see that connection that the kingdom is near. And we'll talk more about that when we get to that verse in the discussion here. In this part, this first part is connected with the first prediction. Again, Peter makes his great confession, we note here, and Jesus relates the cost of discipleship, to take up your cross. We also see that the transfiguration is here later in chapter 9, which is what that illustration there is. This is connected to the idea of the kingdom coming. As it was stated, but perhaps summarized, when Jesus began his ministry in 1:15, Mark chapter 1, verse 15, and a greater emphasis is given here in chapter 9 and verse 1. All right. So that's the transition. How are we on time? We got plenty of time. All right. So let us now look at this first prediction here in 8:31. This isn't exactly what people expected, was it, of a Messiah? We note that it says, "And he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and scribes, and be killed, and after 3 days rise again." So now a question: what was the common conception of the Messiah that the Jews had at this time? And many modern Jews still have this conception. Do you remember what that is?
Yeah, they were expecting a military conqueror. They were expecting David to come back on a white horse and kick the Romans out and reestablish, you know, a bit.
Yeah. They were expecting that very thing. They were expecting that he would. They were expecting a conquering Messiah, one who would restore their kingdom, bringing them to their what they thought was their rightful place as God's people. That they were going to expel the Romans, and that they would have their own nation again and be as it was before, but better. Well, after Peter's confession, we note that the disciples, as we see, recognize Jesus as the Messiah. It says that that you are the Christ, and if we remember, Christ is Greek Christos, which is Hebrew Mashiach, and we translate that or transliterate that to Messiah. So this is the Messiah is Hebrew for the Anointed One, which is Christ. So this is the same thing. So if they say that he is the Christ, then they're saying, oh, he's the Messiah. So there's that connection here. that they somehow think that that they have come to the realization that he is the Messiah, that he is the Christ. So how then could he, if he is the Messiah, if he's the Christ, and they're expecting him to be a conquering Messiah, how then could he suffer? How could he be rejected? How could he be killed? You know, this doesn't fit into Peter's idea of who the Christ was supposed to be. This wouldn't meet his expectations, but I have a question. You don't have to answer this. This is more rhetorical. How often do expectations meet reality? They don't very often, do they? And that's really the source for disappointment that a lot of people have. We're often, whenever we're disappointed, you know, some people will say they're managing their expectations. If their expectations aren't too high, then they're not going to be disappointed. Now, I usually come at that with movies. if I see a movie, I'm like, well, I'm going to manage my expectations because movies aren't very good. Some of them are great. Don't get me wrong. But some are like, I don't know. You didn't, that was not the right, that didn't make sense. Why did you do that? But we can talk about all sorts of things. Christmas, all the gifts you think you might be getting. We might not do that as much as adults these days, but sometimes we still get that feeling of, oh, what am I gonna get? What did so and so get me? We should always try to manage our expectations because it might not be the reality. So, how often, again, how often do expectations meet reality? They don't very often. And that's where you get disappointed. And that's where you get this reaction that Peter has for what Jesus said. You see, Jesus, he spoke openly to to his disciples here, but at note we note that Peter takes him aside. He takes him aside away from the other disciples and told him that this wasn't going to happen. In fact, we read exactly what he said in Matthew chapter 16, verse 22. We see that, no, this isn't going to happen. Far be it, Lord. And so here's a thought then. Have you ever spoken, again, a rhetorical question, have you ever spoken to a friend who was suffering and in pain, who thinks he is dying, and perhaps he is, and he wants to share some last things with you? What might you say? I don't know about you, and I don't know what I would say necessarily, but some people would say, hey, now don't talk that way. Don't talk that way. You're gonna get through this. You'll make it. You'll tell them yourself. You'll take care of it yourself. That kind of thing. And I have a feeling that this is the same attitude that Peter had toward Jesus. Yeah, don't talk like that. That's not gonna happen. He's not wanting his friend to suffer and die. He doesn't want the man that he now identifies as the Christ to be killed. And then Jesus says, "Get behind me, Satan. Get behind me, Satan." Now, do you suppose he's talking directly to Peter here when he says, "Get behind me, Satan"? Do you think he's calling Peter Satan? I don't know. But, oh, you have something, Sam?
I think the next thing that's said gives some indication, because he says, "For you do not," I can't, I don't have the verse in front of me, but here, he's obviously responding to what Peter says, and then he says, "For you do not have in mind the things of God, but the things of men." So at that point, I think he is talking to Peter. But for sure, if you remember the temptation of Jesus, it says that Satan left him until a more appropriate, another opportune time to tempt him. And I'm sure that this was very tempting for Jesus to look in the eyes of his disciple that he loved. He loved his disciples that way because he just didn't understand.
And you're getting ahead of me just a little bit, but I kind of asked the
Sorry.
question. No, that's okay. I asked the question, so it's understandable. So do you remember when Satan, and Sam brought it up just now, but when Satan tempted Jesus in the wilderness? Do you remember in Luke chapter 4, I have it up there, Luke chapter 4, verse 13, Luke recorded this ominous phrase that the devil departed from him until an opportune time. Now, that seems to indicate that now we have no record exactly of Satan directly working on Jesus or tempting Jesus up to this point. So when would that opportune time come? Well, I'd imagine it would come at his weakest point, or when he is, or at some weak points ahead. And perhaps this is one of those. Maybe Satan is working through Peter at this point. As we'll note later, Jesus wanted nothing more than to escape what he knew had to happen. We'll see that in Mark chapter 14, verse 36. He wanted to escape this. Satan had offered him an out those few years before. And now, through Peter, again, this is how my mind's working, how I'm thinking about this. And now, through Peter, he was offering an out again. Man, you don't have to go through this. That's the same thing Satan was saying in the garden, or in the wilderness, I should say. Same thing Satan was saying in the wilderness. You don't have to go through this. And now Peter is saying the exact same thing. You know, that's not to suggest that Peter was demon-possessed or anything of that nature, but his heart was hardened. We had talked about that already. And he only saw as the blind man did in Mark 8, 24, like men like trees walking. He didn't see things quite clearly. Jesus in the next... Oh, yeah, what's up?
Just a comment. You know, we have that specific instance of Jesus being in the wilderness and Satan tempting him, you know, head on. But Jesus led, you know, the scriptures tell us that he was tempted in every way as we are, and yet without sin. You know, he was facing temptation his whole life, just like we do. It wasn't like he only had these three strikes and here's a fourth strike, right? You know, as long as you can get through those, he's okay. He was tempted. You know, we sing that song. He could have called 10,000 angels to destroy the world. He could have. The same Lord that could make bread appear could make swords appear. The same one that calmed the sea could have wiped out the earth. And all through that, to the point when he was dying on the cross, he always had that option. And I think those are all temptations that sometimes we don't think about as much because he's such an amazing example of one who was victorious over those temptations.
Right. And for the record, I never said that he wasn't tempted. I just said it wasn't recorded.
Of course.
Yeah. So let's see. All right, so in this next verse, in verse 33, it says that Jesus, we know that Jesus looks at his disciples, that Jesus that Peter had taken Jesus aside, and now Jesus, after hearing what Peter had said, we don't know if the disciples could hear what Peter said, but Jesus looks at his disciples, and I don't know what he's thinking about. It doesn't say, but perhaps he's thinking of the love that he has for them, knowing that he needs to die for them and for all others who would believe on his name through their word. We know, as we've already talked about this, that Jesus rebukes Peter, calling him Satan. Perhaps not literally Satan, but as was stated, that Peter was tempting him as Satan tempted him. You don't have to go through this. You can avoid it if you want. And he told Peter that he was not looking at things from God's perspective. Sam mentioned that earlier. He's not looking at things from God's perspective. He's caring more for the temporal, for the things that are temporary. He's caring more about the fact that he's going to suffer and die than for the things that are eternal, for the victory, for the eternal life that can be had through Jesus, through his death and resurrection. All right. Final comments. Okay. So that is it for today. We'll continue finishing this up, starting in Mark chapter 8, verse 34, and I hope we'll finish the chapter next week. I think we will, and we may move on. At least talk about the start talking about the Transfiguration next week. Perhaps we'll see.